join me, please, in a word of prayer? Lord, I ask that you would let it be that the words of my mouth and the meditations, all those who hear those words, would be pleasing and honoring in your sight. And my rock, my redeemer. Amen. Well, welcome to week two in our, the Ravi Zacharias, Jesus among secular gods, but I called it just among secular gods, because not only is Jesus there among secular gods, but we are all there among secular gods as well. If you're following along in the Ravi Zacharias book, which I invite you to do, he uses bigger words, and he will make it a little more complicated than I'm going to make it, and I do some, or talk about some stuff he doesn't, and vice versa. But I invite you to do that. You might notice, if you do, though, that he has another chapter that we're not going to get into called Atheism, but he just basically beats up on Richard Dawkins, which is a good pastime for anybody to do, because that guy needs a little bit of that. But we're not doing that because really a lot of these isms are atheists. So we're kind of addressing that as we go through. What we're going to look at this week is scientism. I just want to stop before we really even get into it and say the whole premise for this series in the first place is that 1 Peter 3:15 verse that I just would remind you of here. In fact, would you join me and let's just read this together. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect. That is really the essence. That is what we're called to do. That is part of the Christian life. And that's what I'm hoping we will be even better prepared to do at the end of this series. One other thing, due to the extreme technological advances in our society today, I'm not doing like text in answer or questions. But if you think of a question during the message, I'm going to hang around afterwards. That's our low-tech version of that. I'm going to hang around up here afterwards. And if there's anything that piques your interest, come up and we will chat about it in a tone of semi privacy. So one of those questions might be, and I'll just beat you to the punch here, why is this important, right? Reasonable question if you haven't asked it already. I assume you think it's important, Pastor Michael. We wouldn't be almost exclusively found in our schools. If your kid doesn't go here, chances are that is the only interpretation of reality they will get through schools. And we actually have public school teachers right here who sort of battle that in clandestine ways. And if I could we just pause for a moment and give a little round of applause? Not an easy job. Not an easy job at all. But an important job. One other reason, and maybe the biggest reason, I think, is we are all created, I believe, we are all created to be eternal beings, right? That means that everybody lives forever. Everybody lives forever somewhere, right? And either you live with God or you don't. And we, as Christians, as those who have embraced an idea of living with Jesus forever, that doesn't stop there, does it? Shouldn't we be concerned for other people who follow a lot of these isms and the places that they go? I'm not sure how well thought out some of that really is. So maybe that is the biggest and most important reason. Maybe that's the thing that should motivate us more than anything else, is the people who don't realize that they are going to live forever and they hadn't given any thought of what that means. Where they'll be and with whom or without whom. For those who are non-science people, who are like, you know, I'm not really into this kind of thing. I don't really get science. Science isn't my thing. I want to say one word of encouragement to you. Yeah, neither do a lot of people who embrace scientism. not all science. You know, it sounds like scientists, and I want to be really clear. You know, someone who embraces pluralism, you could say he's a pluralist or she's a pluralist. Someone who embraces scientism doesn't mean that they're a scientist, right? So if you are a little averse to science, it's okay. A lot of people who kind of just spout this stuff off really don't get it either. And we're going to do kind of a top view of a bunch of this stuff. So you don't have to be a scientist to get this and to talk about this. A non-science person absolutely can talk about this. Well, before we go any further, let's stop beating around the bush and get a definition of scientism. So scientism believes that science can explain not just a lot, but everything. That everything that is can be defined scientifically. And I said this before, all these isms, they're not all bad. A lot of them, all of them really have at least some good to it. So I think we should acknowledge just here up at the beginning that science is good, right? Science does explain a lot of stuff. It is a wonderful tool for us. In fact, don't fall into that false dichotomy, this opposition where it's science versus religion. Science and religion, maybe not in harmony, but they existed, you know, side by side for millennia, not just centuries, but for thousands of years. And in the interest of, you know, owning up some of the blame here, it was the church that really led to the break between these when they overstepped and started trying to assert some stuff about the earth being in the center of the universe that the Bible doesn't even teach. So we're at fault, really, for some of the break, but it doesn't have to be. We don't need conflict between science and religion. But while we own up some of the stuff that we do, I want you to understand that there's some of that sort of dogma, you know, the zealot kind of behavior from scientists as well. Science really kind of spouts some stuff that they hold on to with a fanaticism. Science actually proves, or, you know, very strongly suggests that the universe or life anyway can't begin automatically out of, primordial ooze, like they used to say, you know, that there's just this magical cocktail that exists and a bolt of lightning hits it and life begins, and people who understand the proteins that need to be present for that to happen say, I don't think so. I've heard scientists actually suggest that, well, maybe other worlds, alien races came and seeded life here, and you're thinking, really? What scientific, where do you get that from? But you can hold on to a lot of beliefs like that. Evolution actually has come under fire with the same sort of actual statistics, and people really get angry and don't argue logically. Instead, they just start accusing and pointing fingers and ostracizing. So it's both sides that will end up in this kind of argument, and the reason for that is, I think scientism embraces something called the God of the gaps. Now, what this means, essentially, is that way back primitive man didn't understand their surroundings. Okay, the sun comes up and you don't know how, so you say, God. God did it. Apollo is riding his chariot across the sky, but then later we figure out, no, it's actually this giant ball of gas 93 million miles away. So we don't need God to explain that anymore. We don't need God to explain lightning. We don't need God to explain diseases. And the role of God in our lives gets smaller and smaller and smaller as science explains more and more and more. That's a different way, a fundamentally different way of looking at God, though, isn't it? That we only need him to explain things that we can't get. There's some assumptions there, too. Let's just go ahead and say it. First of all, you think eventually you're going to be able to explain everything. Now, we've been able to explain a lot, but is there going to be a point where we can really explain everything? It also assumes that we really have a much better hold on what's going on than we actually do. And the more you dig into things, the more you find out, well, maybe we don't have quite the hold on things that we thought we did. Just for giggles, I'm going to talk to you for just a little bit about the string theory. You want to talk about string theory? Let's just humor me for a minute. I won't get too incredibly boring on this, although don't take my word for it. Let's judge afterwards. All right, string theory. We begin with everybody's favorite, quantum mechanics. That is really the study of the smallest things you can possibly... I know I'm losing some of you already. Stick with me. We've got it. The smallest things you can possibly imagine. The ancient Greeks, thought that was the atom. That's where the word comes from. The smallest thing that there possibly is. Well, we discovered that there's smaller things than atoms, right? I think we all learned this way back in grade school. There's protons and neutrons in the center, right? Electrons that go around. It's kind of like our solar system. Pretty cool. And then we said, no, there's things that are even smaller than that. That the electrons are the small parts, but protons and neutrons, they're actually made up of quarks. And everybody knows what quarks are, right? Up, down, bottom, top, strange, and no, you don't know those. That's okay. That's okay. Because here's the thing. The quarks, the very smallest, this is still what science says right now. Quarks are the very smallest, most fundamental, or quantum. That's what that word means. Quanta in the entire universe. Everything is made up of quarks. And we always thought of all these things as dots, sort of single points. Just infinitesimally small, no breadth, length, width, anything like that. But the math didn't come out right. And so string theory came along and said they're not dots. They're actually kind of like rubber bands. You can see it right there in the middle there. Light isn't great, but you can imagine that. An extremely thin rubber band that vibrates, and that's how you can determine whether it's an up quark, a down, whatever type of quark it is determined by the vibration that thing gives off. And if you have a worldview, remember we talked about worldview last week, if your worldview is scientism, science can explain everything, then you go, wow, this was the greatest mystery of our time, and we've explained it. We don't hardly need God for anything anymore, right? But if you have a different worldview, like my worldview, you say, isn't it fascinating that those things vibrate just like a chord on a guitar or a vocal cord, right? And Genesis began how? God spoke. Said, let there be light, and there was, and God creates through His voice, and here, thousands of years at least, tens of thousands, millions, depending on whatever you believe, later, the very fundamental elements of the universe are still vibrating like that, still resonating, maybe with the voice of God. That's the same information, the same data, the same starting point. But depending on your worldview, man, you have completely different understanding of the universe and what it means and how it came to be. And you don't have to give up on your brain and abandon intellect and reason to do that. Well, that's an idea, I think, of, again, how we can understand and how our worldview is going to affect this. But the real question is, how do we talk to people? How do we talk to scientists? How do we talk to people who embrace scientism? It's going to be the same types of answers, I think, for all these different isms. But let's begin with a simple first step. And that's number one. Remember this, Proverbs 9, 7 through 8. It says, whoever corrects a mocker invites insult, and whoever rebukes the wicked incurs abuse. Do not rebuke mockers, or they will hate you. Rebuke the wise, and they will love you. And I tell you this, because there are people who will do nothing but mock Christianity. And it is actually not your job to argue with these people. When I'm talking about having conversations with people who follow these different isms, if someone is embracing scientism, if you have a relationship with them, then talk to them. But if you don't, you don't need to argue with them, because the Bible warned you right here, you're just going to get abused. Your job isn't to argue with, again, our friend Richard Dawkins. Let's look at what he likes to say about Christianity. If you want to believe in, and he goes on for a little bit and comes back, unicorns or tooth fairies, Thor or Yahweh, that is the personal name of God. Thank you, Richard. The onus is on you to say why you believe in it. The onus is not on the rest of us to say why we do not. Well, that's, I would like that too. I would like to put all the burden of proof on someone else. Because isn't it so much easier that way? In the book, Ravi Zacharias shares a story about an Indian sitting next to Einstein on a plane that's going from London to New Delhi. And Einstein, to pass the time, turns to the Indian and says, let's play a game. I propose that we play a game. I will ask you a question, and if you don't know the answer, you have to give me $50. And then you can ask me a question, and if I don't know the answer, I have to give you $500. And the Indian thinks, wow, man, I'm no match for Einstein, clearly, who is, but that's 10-to-1 odds. I know maybe some philosophy or some trivia. Maybe I could stick in this game, you know, at that kind of exchange rate. Maybe I could stick in the game for a while. So he agrees. So Einstein says, all right, I go first. Do you know the distance between the Earth and the Moon? Indian goes, well, I confess I don't know the exact distance. So he reaches in his pocket and he hands Einstein $50. And Einstein says, all right, your turn. So the Indian says, what goes up the mountain with four legs but comes down the mountain with three legs? And Einstein thinks for a little bit. And he reaches in his pocket and he gives the Indian $500. And the Indian says, Einstein, it's your turn. And then Einstein says, before we begin, though, or before I take my turn, what does go up the mountain with four legs and comes down with three legs? And the Indian pauses for a minute and then reaches in his pocket and gives Einstein the $50. And the point is, as you can see, sometimes we ask questions of other people that we are not able to answer ourselves. And I think the same thing is true of a lot of these isms. We pose all these questions because it feels great to be Richard Dawkins and then just go, this is stupid and this is ridiculous and how naive are you for that? And it's so much easier when you don't have to defend whatever your worldview is. And that brings me to the second point, is that is, ask questions and not the kind of questions that the Indian asked where you're just trying to stump somebody. But ask the kinds of questions that we talked about last week. Remember, when we're talking about worldview, we ask these questions. We ask questions on origin, meaning, ethics, and destiny, because Christianity has answers for these kinds of things. And when you start to really explore them, other isms, other worldviews, they don't. So let's break this down, actually, for just a minute. Origin, purpose, ethics, destiny. Let's begin with origin. There's a parable that a historian named John Wisdom and a philosopher named Anthony Flew came up with. It's called the Parable of the Invisible Gardener. It goes like this: two explorers are going through the jungle, and they happen upon a beautiful garden with flowers that you don't find anywhere else, and fruit from fruit trees that aren't anywhere else either. And Explorer A says, there must be a gardener. Explorer B says, there is no gardener. So to settle their dispute, they sit down and they wait. And they wait for a really long time, but no gardener shows up. Explorer A says, the gardener must be invisible. Explorer B says, there is no gardener. So they set up traps all around the garden, and they bring in bloodhounds to be able to smell out the scent of the gardener. But they still find no gardener. And so Explorer A says, the gardener must be invisible, intangible, and without any kind of scent. And at this point, the Explorer B says, what's the difference between an invisible, intangible gardener with no scent at all and no gardener at all? And the point of the parable was supposed to be that there's no, it's not about a gardener, it's about God, and that all these excuses we make for God really is no different than no God at all. But I read this once again and I go, well, the difference is you have a gardener, right? And it's really nice to be in the Richard Dawkins shoes and say it's your job to come up with an excuse, a reason, a rationale that has no holes in it whatsoever, no point where you have to say, I just don't know, an airtight case for the existence of God, and it's my job just to poke holes. But that's not true, is it? Because we're living in a garden. What's your explanation for this? How did all this get here? I think no matter what your worldview is, you have to have some kind of answer for our origin. There's actually just a few different options for them, and they're all ridiculous. Let's look at those for a second. Option A, the universe has always existed. Option B, the universe popped into existence with no cause at all. Or option C, a being from outside of time and space created all of this. They're all ridiculous. They're all really hard to wrap your brain around. Let me break them down just a little bit for you. Option A, don't think that it's just existed for a really, really, really long time. When you say it's always existed, that means infinity, my friend. What happens to a cup of coffee when you leave it out for a long time? It becomes room temperature. That's what would happen to the entire universe. Their stars are still burning. They still have heat. Over infinity, we know that things become, the universe would be room temperature by now, and there's really no way around that. In option B, the universe just popped into existence, just out of nowhere, for no cause. Because if there was something that caused it, well, now you're getting back into option C, which again is kind of crazy. But when I look at these three, I have to say option C is much less crazy than the other two. Since when do things just pop into existence with no cause at all? How scientific is that? And maybe how desperate are we to avoid God as a cause? And how many reasons are we willing to come up with to avoid that? I think the answer to that question really explains more about our worldview than anything else. The rest of these, as far as origin, purpose, ethics, and destiny, well, destiny is pretty simple from a scientific standpoint. Your destiny is nothing. Your atoms kind of fall apart and are assimilated into other things. You cease to be. When you're dead, that's it. And that sounds kind of okay and noble that you say your life is over and you just have to face that. But I've noticed people aren't really quite as okay with that as they pretend to be. It's a lot more disturbing, and I think the reason is deep down inside, we all know that we are created for more, that we are actually eternal beings. So pretty poor destiny. How about purpose? How about ethics? By that I mean meaning in our lives or morality. Science, again, can't really speak to these things. They're made for a purpose. That's not really in the purview of science. Meaning, ethics, morality. Again, that's outside of science because science can tell you a lot about the way things are, but it can't speak at all to how things should be. C.S. Lewis called it the ought. Science can say nothing about that ought to be. It can just say this is the way it is and make predictions about how it will be in the future, but how things should be, it's totally beyond that. And again, I think that people can talk that way on the surface, but nobody lives that way. Nobody thinks it doesn't make any difference how we behave. And nobody can live, at least happily, without meaning, without purpose. That's an empty existence. Back to our list. How do we talk to them? Number three, we're not asking questions like the Indians just to stump people. We're asking for understanding. And we're not just looking for ammunition to shoot somebody back down. That can go so far when you're having a conversation with someone. To seek to understand them, because again, all of these different isms have good things about them. People with good motivation. And the person you're talking to is somebody that God loves. And the more that we can reflect that and represent that ourselves, the better we will be. Number four, here's a big one. Could we possibly admit what we don't know? Instead of just trying to make up an excuse or say, God did it that way because he hates you, maybe we could actually just say, you know, I don't know about that. And admit our own shortfallings. And the fifth one, the final one here, is be compassionate. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, at least in terms of atheists especially, conversations that I have had, sometimes it becomes unclear whether someone just doesn't believe in God or someone is just very, very angry at him. Have you had these conversations before? I listened to Richard Dawkins for a while, and he's just attacking God for, paragraphs. Just going on and on about that, and I think, Richard, why are you so angry at someone that you say doesn't exist at all? I mean, if what you think is true and there is no God, I think you're just mad at people. And why is that? That's what you want anyway. It's for just people to run the world. And if that's what's happening, what's the problem? What's happened, I don't want to just lay them down on a psychiatrist's couch, but it's worth questions to kind of probe in and see why they're so upset, why they're so angry, and it may not be so much God at all, but maybe someone who represented God in their lives, and a trust that was betrayed, some kind of really bad experience. What you need to do, if you're in this person's life, if you have a relationship with them, is show compassion. And maybe apologize on behalf of the person that hurt them. But compassion will lead us to that kind of thing. And why? I just come back to this. Because everyone lives forever. Somewhere. And Christ did an incredible thing on the cross, but he didn't just do that for the people in this room, did he? He did that for all of us. He did that for people who don't know him. Right now, maybe they aren't even interested in knowing him, and the only way that they stand a chance to meet him before it's too late is through you. And we're able to do this. We're able to have conversations with people just following these simple steps. Ask questions. Be compassionate. Seek understanding. Love people. Live like Jesus. Would you pray with me, please? Father, this is, we've got to be honest. This is challenging. This is challenging. But because you are with us, I believe that we are up to this task. And so I ask that you would give us the confidence that comes from knowing you. And knowing that we are all better off if we do know you. Lord, give us a heart for those who don't. And give us the courage to step in and have conversations and not be afraid to say, I don't know. And the compassion to say, what do you think about this? And the patience to wait and understand where they're coming from and what we can do to help. We ask all this in Jesus' name.